Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. You can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/lostheplotcast. I highly recommend Amanda Palmer's book, The Art of Asking, and you can get it for free. Just visit audibletrial.com/lostheplotcast. All right, let's do this. From Milieu Media Group, this is Ryan Hamilton's Lost the Plotcast. I'm your host, Ryan Hamilton, and this is Episode 2, Shopping with Dave, with special guest Tim Palmer. Hello, and welcome to Episode 2 of Ryan Hamilton's Lost the Plotcast. I'm Ryan. And before we do anything, I have to say thank you. Episode 1 cracked the top 10 on iTunes. Not just episode 1, but the podcast. We passed Snoop Dogg, Noel Gallagher of Oasis, and an insane list of other huge names. So really, thank you. No one was expecting it. No one was ready. We weren't ready. But, it's just the best. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to happen. And I just love that people are so excited about this thing. I was already excited. I thought it was going to be something new and fun. But like I said, no one was quite ready for that sort of a response. So here we are, episode 2. The podcast has cracked the top 10 on iTunes. It's still hanging around in the charts. For episode 2, I want to talk about and share a conversation I had with Tim Palmer. Tim Palmer is a Grammy-nominated producer and mixer. The list of clients is just insane. He's responsible for, well, I guess the bands are partially responsible, but he's responsible for albums like Pearl Jam's 10, U2, All That You Can't Leave Behind, which he was nominated for a Grammy for, Tears for Fears, Robert Plant, Ozzy Osbourne. The list goes on and on and on. He's still killing it today, working with artists like my friends Blue October. The dude is a legend and arguably the most successful, talented person I have the pleasure of knowing. So I was honored that he agreed to do this. He invited me into his home studio in Austin, Texas, which was great. It was insane to walk in and see all of the gold and platinum records on the walls. What a career this dude has had and continues to have. I do want to give you the heads up about this. The core conversation that we had, or at least the part of it that I really want to share, was really great. It was an incredible insight into a producer's point of view and what it's been like to go through the change into the digital music world and then navigate the super tricky financial waters, if you will. Because now people are funding their own albums, they're recording them at home. So somebody like Tim, who was uber just crazy successful, still is, but there was definitely a moment when he had to go, what am I going to do? How do I find a way to maintain the success that I've had for all these years with smaller budgets and less time and digital music and people recording albums at home on their laptops? He just had a really interesting and just kind of cool. He made me think about things in ways I really never had. But after that core conversation, I had to ask him. He worked with David Bowie. Bowie is a personal hero of mine. I had to ask him. I couldn't pass up the opportunity to ask someone what David Bowie was like just as a person, just to kind of hang out with, not just to work with. I wanted to know about that too. I could have done the whole podcast just asking him about David Bowie and hearing him tell stories. I don't want to give too much away, but this podcast is a little bit longer. After this core conversation, there are some David Bowie stories, and you'll hear me totally nerd out. But this core conversation is an important one, I think. It's something just to kind of continue the theme that I want to have on this podcast that you probably never thought about. Several different things, actually. I first met Tim when my former band, Smile Smile, was doing our first big record label release. It was my first experience in a, quote, big studio with a big budget and all those things that you dream about as a young artist. We had gone in and recorded this album, and we were super happy with it. We thought it was done. And then, and this is what you'll hear Tim and I start this conversation with. The label told us, I'll never forget this because I was so confused when I first heard it. They said, okay, now we need a name. We need a name to mix it. Who can we get? And it's just crazy to me the way this business works sometimes. So the album was done, but it wasn't really done because they wanted a name. And like you'll hear me say, lucky for us, the name was Tim Palmer and he did an amazing job. But I do have friends in this business and other people that had an album that they were happy with and they thought was finished. And then the label got involved because they wanted a name and somebody got in there and, you know, the band wasn't happy with the mix. They weren't happy with whatever the guy did, the name. But in this business, sometimes the name attached to something is seemingly more important than the music. And I think that that is so, excuse me, but fucking backwards. I really do hate that. Call me crazy, but I think if the music is good and the songs are good and it sounds good and the band is happy, then put it out. Stop trying to find empty ways to further a career. And look, we all hope we get lucky or we catch a break, but I just hate it. I hate it when the music suffers. And like I said, we were lucky to get Tim Palmer when the label was searching for a name. I love that he's stayed a friend. I have so much respect for that man and his talent, but there have been a lot of other people not so lucky. Okay, let's get into this talk with Tim Palmer. Really hope you guys enjoy this. Here we go. The first time I had the pleasure of meeting you, this is what we had been told by the label, right? We knew we had good songs. I felt like I had good songs. I was still pretty damn green then. We had recorded the songs, and then they said something that I had never heard before, and this is before I knew you, so no offense here. They said, okay, now we need a name to mix it. And I went, what? I don't understand what you're saying. You need a name to mix it. Lucky for me, that name was Tim Palmer, and we've gone to be friends. And I didn't understand kind of what the point was there. It's like, why do you need...
Yeah.
I don't really understand. Is that something that bothers you as a producer? Somebody saying, well, we need a name to mix it. Or is that something that just kind of comes with it? Like, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that... I mean, what the label are trying to do is they are trying to, you know, sort of, in quotes... I'm doing quotes here,
mm-hmm.
is to maximize their investment by taking as little chance as they can. And if you're a name as such, arguably you've had quite a lot of success, so mm-hmm. you're more likely to have it again than someone who isn't.
Mm.
That's their thinking. Of course, it doesn't really follow at all because it's not going to be a huge success unless it's great anyway. And also, there was a time when terrestrial radio would see certain names appearing and they also... felt like, oh, if so-and-so worked on it, it's probably going to be pretty cool
mm-hmm.
because he's cool, and if he's chosen to work on it, you know, so there was that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, it was all a load of bollocks, but
yeah.
but I can see their thinking,
yeah.
you know. It was very frustrating to people who are, you know, often had done a great job mm-hmm. and they were pushed out of the way to get somebody with a name who might not even have done a better job than they did,
yeah.
but they didn't have the name, so, you know. It's good and bad, but I understand right. how it happened.
Well, luckily, you're really good at what you do, and we hit the jackpot with those particular songs on that album, the ones you did. I still go back and listen every once in a while, and it's like, oh my god, just tiny little, what I call candy parts, little
right.
guitar things and stuff that you added, that just made the songs, it elevated the songs to what everybody hoped that they could be. So we got really lucky. I do have some friends that have not been so lucky, who, you know, were really happy, just like you just described,
yeah.
with a mix or a master or whatever,
yeah.
but the label wanted a name. And then they were like, what the hell is this? Well, it doesn't matter because so-and-so's name is attached to it.
Yeah.
And that gets tricky for me because I hear what you're saying. It's good and it's bad.
The industry sort of moved into a lot of subsets. Traditionally, when I first started out, the way that a producer would work, his role was to come in at the very beginning, help a band with their arrangements, mm-hmm. help them choose the songs, mm-hmm. rehearse with them, work on the parts, then take them into the studio, oversee the recording with an engineer of the producer's choice, making sure each sound was the way that the band and they wanted it, get the performances right, get the vocal performances great, and then to finish it all off, mix it with the same engineer.
Yeah.
So you worked with two guys that would basically make your record. Now, as you know, particularly in certain genres of music like R&B and rap, you have one guy that does beats, one guy that does the vocal treatments, one guy that works on this and that. And then as far as the writing could be like 15 writers because you've got a sample of this song, you've got a sample. Yeah. So everything is very different now to the way that I originally did it. And what I would say is that, you know, the concept of a mixer came in the 80s. One of the first mixers who was known to be brought in to give that fresh perspective was Tom Lord Alge.
Right.
And I mean, he's obviously an amazing mixing engineer, and he started that trend as far as I remember, or at least he was the first one that came up on my radar, where a record would be taken away from a producer and handed to a third party because maybe they're a bit burnt on it. Let's bring some fresh ears in. And there is, once again, there's pros and cons to that.
Yeah.
Sometimes you lose the thread of the concept of the record because you've had a plan for how this will
work.
And
there's like a family there.
Yeah, and you've had a plan and you've had an idea. Like, these backing vocals are not supposed to be treated this way, they're supposed to be treated that way.
Yeah.
These drums should be soft and kept at the back. Whereas you hand it to someone else, they don't know that plan.
Yeah.
But at the same time, sometimes that plan's gone a bit off.
Yeah.
And somebody new coming in going, well, that's a load of bollocks, that idea. Let's get the kick and snare to sound ballsy. And then you actually bring something to the table that they'd never considered. So it was quite a good idea. I mean, the only thing that bothered me was I always felt that what should happen would be to allow the thing to progress to the point where you're not happy and then think, okay, we're not happy, let's bring in someone else.
Yeah.
But let the people who have a plan at least finish the vision. And then if it's not really what you were expecting, then maybe we'll bring in a different mixer and try something.
Yeah.
But too often things were taken away. And I've been guilty. I remember doing some records in the 90s where I know the producers were mad because I was brought in to mix it, and they felt that they should have at least tried to mix it first, and they probably should have done. It's not the way it went.
Let's move to this, because I think this is a good opportunity. So you've seen the music business change a lot, and not just the business side, but the way that albums are made, right? So it's gone from tape to a more digital world. I want to know what your initial feeling was when it started to move more digital and move away from that. I keep wanting to say the word organic, but that's not really the word, I don't guess.
Yeah.
But what was your initial reaction when things started moving into a digital format, into a more digital format?
Well, there's two things to consider there. The first thing is, like you said, the change in the way that people were recording when the concept of digital reared its head. So that was a big change. And then there's the changes to the actual industry into how music was going to be made because of the finances and because of the sharing of music. So there's two things going on. They're both very separate. I mean, the beginning of digital, I was one of those sort of Luddites that were dragging their feet because I had no problem with the way things were.
I think I would have been the same.
I went to see a demonstration at Westlake Audio when I was producing Tears for Fears in Los Angeles, and they'd had a setup in this room. And I went in, and the guy gave me the big sell, showed me the screen, and for the first time, seeing the waveforms and scrolling.
Was it Pro Tools?
Yeah, it was an early form of it. I think it was Sonic Solutions or something at that time. But I remember looking at my engineer at the time and saying, you know, I just don't think I really want this there. I don't want to look at sound. I'm fine just listening. I don't want to use my eyes. I never wanted to, you know, apart from setting up a microphone,
right.
You know, turning knobs. I didn't really want to look at, I didn't want to be a computer engineer, is what I thought. And I was very slow to consider that alternative. And when people started to embrace it, I realized that if I didn't at least figure this out, then I probably wouldn't have a career for much longer. So that was a big turning point for me, was accepting and trying this thing.
Yeah.
And it was through being forced into it that I appreciate now how incredible it really is.
Yeah.
And I am not one of these people who romanticize about the past anymore, by any means.
Yeah.
I feel I have more control over everything I do than I've ever had before. And it's opened up opportunities to reach people in other places, in other countries easier. The digital has really helped. I mean, it was definitely a case of, with the digital format, with file sharing and things, with one hand it was taking away and it was giving us back something else with the other hand. There was definitely a tugging going on there. But as far as working within the digital world, you know, analog was fabulous and it was good fun, but you were limited. You had to make compromises, and I've never really been a big fan of compromises. So I like the fact that if I want to get in and really try something and really go for it, you can do it now.
Yeah.
And then you can go back if you don't like it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and one thing, one advantage, just my personal experience, the rest of my band is in England. They all live there.
Yeah.
So for us to record, you know, just fun extra things or demo songs or whatever, with the ability to do that with digital files and the internet, we're sending, you know, Mickey, our drummer, he's sending me drum stuff, I'm sending him guitar parts.
It works, right?
Yeah. Can you imagine trying to do that, mailing, what, tape?
Oh, it wouldn't work.
You know what I mean?
Like, but once again, there's two sides to that. That is an amazing thing that you can do that. You've also lost the fact that you're standing in front of the guy and having that conversation.
That's true.
Where something might have happened where he goes, oh, I know what you mean, Ryan.
Yeah.
I'll try this. And you go, that's even better.
Yeah.
Right? So the human interaction has been lost, which is sad because it was apart from anything else, being creative and great, it was bloody fun too.
Yeah.
But it is amazing what you can do. For me, as a... Justin from Blue October always uses the word stunt guitarist. I'm a stunt guitarist. I need all the tricks. But I have definite ideas. When I hear songs, I think, oh, I know what I want to do. And I would hate to pick up a guitar in front of you now and you see the way that I get to the point where I want to present it. Because I might go through a lot of wrong things before I find the thing I want. And then how I play it, maybe I'll split it into three parts so I can play it right. But the digital has given us that, is that when I'm working on songs with people from another country, I can sit and formulate my ideas and get them just how I want them before I submit them.
Oh, right.
You know?
Yeah, that's great.
And, you know,
I hadn't really thought about it from that.
Because you can, you don't feel like, oh, I can't possibly play it, but if you could just imagine this, but now you don't have to imagine anything. You can present it with the delay in the right spot and the right tremolo at the end of the line or whatever it is you're doing. It gives you the opportunity to present your ideas in full, which I really like.
That's great. What do you think about people now, since the ability is there, making albums on their own? This probably happens quite a bit now. People work with a producer, you know, or they have for years, but now because... either they've been through the process or, you know, maybe the technology is there, people go, you know, I'm going to make an album on my own now. Is that difficult? Not on a personal friendship level, because that's got to sting at least just a little bit. You're like, oh, I want to work on the record. I'd be that way. But do you think that it's a good idea, or do you think people should be making albums on their own, or do you think they should have somebody there with a producer's point of view?
I tell you what I think. I don't think that they necessarily should, but I think they have to. I think the way that our industry is now with the finances of it, for many, many artists, they can't afford to go to a fancy studio and spend a week recording drums with a producer of note and an engineer of note. They can't.
Yeah. Right?
So they've adapted to dealing with the situation they're presented with. What's happened is the role that the mixing engineer plays has changed drastically, or at least it has in my world, drastically in the last 10 years. There was a point when mixing, if you sent me a song and you'd spent 2 weeks recording it with a producer you liked, I would listen to it and think, okay, they know what they're doing, they've carved out what they're trying to, their vision. Now I'll put the finishing touches on, I'll be balancing, I'll be enhancing. But I'm going to stay true to what they're doing because I know that they've put a lot of time into this. I can hear that. Now you get mixes in and you think, okay, well, they've recorded this, sounds like in their front room.
Yeah.
The drums sound like a piece of shit.
Yeah.
The guy that they were working with has got some great ideas, but he hasn't really figured it out yet.
Yeah.
The engineer's done a pretty great job, but it's so-so.
Yeah.
So what do I do? So as a mixer, suddenly your role is, okay, well, I'm going to take what they've done and now I'm going to finish the job. The mixer will like say, right, okay, well, let's sort the drums out first, we'll put some better sounds on there, And then, you know, if there's any dodgy bits of timing, we can fix that, we can help it, we can nudge things, massage them as such.
Yeah.
And then you go through with the vocals, you might need to pitch a couple of bits here and there. And then as far as, like, the chorus doesn't really lift, I think I've got an idea for a part that could be really good. I'm going to add a little extra guitar part. I'm going to double that part in the second verse with a tremolo guitar just to shift the stereo around.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a bit of percussion in that middle section. I'm going to do this, that, and the other. And you basically sort of put additional production on, fix a few things, and mix it. And in a way, that's what's expected of you as a mix now.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes I'll do that. And now send it off, and this, you know, it's a very strange, isolated world that I live in, because as you can see, my little room, I'm in here on my own.
Right.
And you think, well, I wonder if they're going to like it. I have no idea. I've never met them before. I don't even know what they look like. Right. So you send off a file and send an email out and say, look, I tried a few things, you know, have a listen. And they come back and be like, sounds great, man. Can you turn the hi-hat up in the second verse? And and you think, have you noticed the fact that it's completely different now?
Yeah. It's you want more.
Yeah, you know, have you actually spotted the fact that it's now in time?
Yeah, right.
But that's what a mixer does now.
Yeah.
It's expected of you in a way.
Dude, it would drive me crazy to spend all the time and send it off and not get basically a paragraph back of, this is great here, this is great. I can't believe you did this with the drums, it's amazing. Yeah. That's what I would want in return.
Because we work in isolation, it is nice when people at least spend a couple of minutes saying, oh, I really like this and this, and then go on to, could we try? You're like, of course you can try.
Yeah.
But if somebody just writes straight away, I don't like this, you think, right, well, you can fuck right off.
I agree, okay? Dude. I would be exactly the same.
And another thing I've learned is with mix notes is never make the mistake of opening any mix changes on your iPhone, because the iPhone screen's so small. Sometimes I'm out having dinner and I've spent ages on a song, and my wife will say, what are you looking at your phone for? I say, oh, I just want to see that they've come through with their mix notes, and I click on it, and I feel like I'm scrolling forever, and I'm like, fuck these guys. But then when you get back to the studio, you open it up on a proper screen, and it's only like two lines.
Yeah.
It's nothing, but it seemed like it went on forever.
I've never thought about that ever. That's incredible.
It's a whole different world. You know, it's not all bad. I mean, if we were getting paid what we used to, it would be amazing, because I really love the creativity of it now.
Yeah. What was it like to go from, because you've had, you know, gold, platinum, all of the success, right? And the days of big budgets too, money to spend on albums and time, you know? And now everything is, compared to back in the day, it's very short. It's maybe a week, 2 weeks, whatever. The budgets are insanely smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is trying to make a living, take care of their families, feed themselves. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So what was that like for you to go from, okay, I'm making this much to produce or mix an album, and now I'm only getting offered this much? Like, how did you navigate those waters?
Well, it was difficult. The first time that I began to notice that things were going to have to change was when labels started to introduce something called a fund.
Mm-hmm.
To say mix a song traditionally in the past, they'd say, we want you to mix our song, can you tell us what studio you'd like to work at? And I'd say, okay, I'd like to work at Larrabee, say.
Right.
So they would book it for you, and I'd work on the song, and I'd call them up and say, I just need a few more hours to get the last things right. And they say, no problem. And then the band would come down and we'd finish the song.
Mm-hmm.
They'd pay me, they'd pay the studio, it was done. Then this fund came up.
Yeah.
And the fund was like, look, you take care of everything, we've got, say, $3,000. So I'd be like, okay. So then it was my job to go to the studio and say, okay, I need a day to mix the studio. How much will you give it to me for? Suddenly you start having to be a wheeler dealer.
Oh, wow.
Oh, can you
and they left that to you?
Yeah, so you would be given the fund.
Uh-huh.
So then you'd pay yourself out of what was left, and you'd have to pay the studio and the costs and the rentals and whatever you needed.
Yeah.
It was your money, go and make it right. So to me, straight away, that was a conflict of interest, because you go to a studio, they say it's $1,200, so you say it's $1,200 for that, I've rented in a couple of bits of gear. You get to the following day and you think, I'd like to spend another day on this, but if I do that,
then you're not,
I won't make any money.
Yeah.
So it was a conflict of interest right there. So that was obviously the moment, a light bulb moment, where I was like, well, if I have my own room, then if I take the fund, I don't have to worry about studio costs, I can agree to the money, and if it takes me a week, it doesn't matter. because the studio is mine. I mean, obviously you've got to rent, and blah blah. But
right.
but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah.
It kept the creativity intact because you didn't have to compromise what you were doing because you were not going to make any money.
Right.
So I built a studio in North Hollywood. I rented a room, and it was expensive.
Yeah.
But it was cheaper than, you know, going to Larrabee or Record sure. Plant or wherever every day. So I did that for a while, and then I thought, well, why am I renting a studio in North Hollywood when if I move to another music city that's a little bit more affordable, I can sell my house in California and build a studio in my home.
Yeah.
So that's welcome to Texas.
Yeah, and here we are.
And Austin. That's why I loved Austin, because I've been to Austin through South by Southwest many right. times. My wife and I flew in for like 2 or 3 weekends to look around. We realized we could afford a much bigger house here, and it would be cheaper, and it would give us enough money to be able to put a room like this in.
Which
it's
is great,
by
the way.
It's been a godsend.
Yeah.
Because not only that, but it's given me the chance to be in control of my hours for the first time, because you've got to remember that studios, you know, were a business separate from yourself, whereas now they're all it's all one. So in those days they'd be like, I'd say, can I have the weekend off to spend with my family this weekend? They're like, well, yeah, we'll be charging the band.
Yeah.
And I'd think, so you're going to charge the band like another couple of grand so I can spend time with my family and they're all staying in the Oakwood.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel too good about that,
right.
so I only ever took Sundays off. They'd let you have one day.
Yeah.
So for the first 20 years of my career, I only ever had Sundays off.
Wow.
So now, having a studio in my house, I love it because, I mean, I guess it's because I'm getting older, but I wake up early in the morning, and sometimes I just come in here, close the big, thick door, and I sit and mix for like 3 hours before the kids even wake up.
That's great.
And then if I don't feel inspired in any way, and I think, fuck this is a pain in the ass, I'm not getting anywhere, I can stop at no cost. You couldn't do that before because you think, I can't stop.
Right.
We're paying this band are paying $1,000 a day for this place.
Right.
So now I can stop and do something else for a few hours.
It's a different world. Huh?
It's a whole different world. And as we said all along, there's good and there's bad.
Yeah.
That's some of the really great stuff.
Yeah.
Being in control of your own life.
Mm.
You know, the bad stuff is just the fact that it's really hard to make the money that we're used to.
Yeah.
In the old days, you were in competition with anyone that could walk into a huge studio with an SSL or a Neve and be able to run that room. Now you're in competition with anyone who has Pro Tools on their laptop.
Yeah, right.
And if they do a great job, and a lot of them do, they could be sitting in a bedroom 4 houses away from you mixing records.
Yeah.
So you're in competition with everybody.
Yeah.
So that's tough. And because nobody buys music anymore, it's all streamed, there's no back end as such.
Yeah.
So why would you want to spend 3 weeks in a studio desperately trying to get vocals right and guitars right with a band when there's no carrot dangled in front of
right.
you? You know, if I do a great job, this is a great band.
Yeah.
We'll all do well. We're all going to do great out of this. But now you think, well, if this does well, you'll go on the road.
Yeah.
And you'll sell loads of T-shirts and you'll have a great career and I'll make no more at all.
No, right.
right. So that's why a lot of producers now are trying to get some sort of back end by asking for, sometimes they might get 25% of the songwriting.
Mm.
Because, I mean, let's face it, they can have a big effect on those songs.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
they're asking for things, and it's not because they necessarily want to, but what else have they got to
do? Yeah, it's true.
And one of the reasons I love being part of the Recording Academy is these are the sort of things that we're taking really seriously. And sure. we, you know, next week we go to Congress again, and we try and explain to them that some of these archaic rules we have about copyright, etc., have to change.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think many of your podcast listeners would even know that terrestrial radio has never paid the artists in America.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know it.
Yeah.
You cover a song, all the money goes to the writers, and you get nothing.
Yeah, and you have to make sure you credit them accordingly, or you get in trouble.
Yeah, and people like Frank Sinatra were trying to change this in the 50s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and the worst part about that is that because it's not reciprocal to Europe, in Europe, everybody gets paid.
Yeah.
Everybody gets a little bit. Even the producers get a little bit. If you get played on the radio, you pay the artist.
Yeah.
You pay the writer.
Even live
you
performance. Pay the, what's it called? PRS?
PRS, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only countries that are left, like America, are North Korea, I think, and Syria. I think it's North Korea and Syria.
Wow.
So we like to keep ourselves nicely aligned there
right.
with some good examples. But because we do this, people like you, as an American artist, if you get played to death, in the UK and you haven't written the song, as the artist, you're not getting any money.
Yeah.
Because they won't pay you, because you're an American. Because we won't pay them and they won't pay us, blah, blah. So people, like, you can imagine how much money is in bank accounts across Europe for people like Beyonce.
I know.
And she can't have it, because until America starts paying the artist, the Europeans are not going to pay the artist. Yeah. So
something's got to change.
Something has to change.
And you kind of answered this question already, but I do just want to kind of ask it a different way. Do you think that the big change you made to adapt to this new version of what the music business on the recording level is build your own studio, and without the studio, do you think you'd still be, I mean, you're still killing it. Do you think that this was kind of, I don't want to say the saving grace, but
I think you can say that.
Yeah.
I don't think that if I was having to deal with the budgets around today and continue to work the way I used to, I wouldn't be able to survive.
Man. Yeah.
So adapt and survive is the motto.
So you've worked with some of my favorite artists ever. I'd love to hear stories about all of them, but I have to ask about Bowie just for me, because he's like, my wife and I both cried the day that he died. Like,
that was awful.
It was a big deal in my life. And I think that a lot of people, you know, when John Lennon died, that's going to, what that was to some people,
it's what it was to us. Yeah.
Yeah. So when Bowie passed, I'll never forget that. I woke Holly up. And I said, you know, David Bowie died. And we were upset. I feel myself getting a little bit upset now.
It was a really strange couple of weeks after, wasn't it?
Yes, because it was.
I think it affected everyone far more than they probably would have even predicted.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, it was a big shock because you kept it very quiet.
Yeah.
I certainly had no idea. And, yeah, it was a sort of a slight daze about everything, really, for a long time.
You did the Tin Machine album.
Yeah.
And
did you?
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So, did you get to spend a lot of FaceTime with him? And what was he like? I have to ask, just because I'm such an admirer and a fan, and he's such an inspiration. Just as a person, what was he like?
He was really, really easy to deal with.
Yeah.
Great to talk to. Obviously, a very wise man.
Mm.
You definitely got the feeling that he had a sort of persona, or I mean, people say that he had many personas, and I definitely got the feeling that because he and I in that Tin Machine situation were the English guys, he sort of became this, all right, Mr. P. He used to call me Mr. P.
Did he?
You know, all right, Mr. P, how's it going? You know, this sort of like accent would appear from his roots,
like Cockney,
a little bit. Whereas when he was talking to the Americans, it was a different thing, the thing that struck me most was how just incredibly talented the guy was, you know, and how I learned so much from him.
Mm.
I mean, I was in a situation to work with David Bowie as a 26-year-old guy, and I didn't have that much experience at that point, definitely compared to now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the same when I worked with Robert Plant. I was really young, probably too young in a way, but like you, I was a big fan of David Bowie, so when I got the phone call from his management company one day, they said, look, are you going to be at home for the next 20 minutes? Because David Bowie is going to call you.
No.
I was like, really?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Wow.
Did you do the thing? Like, are you joking?
Yeah, no, but it was just like, it was just bizarre.
Yeah.
So I sat around and I was thinking, wow, the phone's going to ring any minute and David Bowie's going to be in the
bit. Were you having to like keep yourself calm, or were you ready for
it? I was nervous.
Yeah? Oh, I would have been a wreck.
And the conversation went great because I'd been working with a lot of sort of guitar type alternative guitar bands.
Yeah.
And at that time of the Tin Machine, it was a point in his career where he'd done the 80s with Let's Dance, very polished, big productions, and it's sort of, he'd lost that sort of edgy, sort of more alternative side that some of the Lodger and the Scary Monsters and all the albums have been.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're also brilliant. And he was sort of tired of being the pop star and wanted to do something that just made him feel good again. So the Tin Machine was obviously, as you can hear, is a very uncontrollable sort of fun project.
Yeah.
So he asked me about some of the albums I liked that he'd worked on, and then he told me that he'd heard The Mission UK and The Mighty Lemon Drops and The House of Love and a lot of these sort of bands that I've been doing.
That had to feel incredible
for him.
Which
is amazing.
Yeah.
Reeves Gabrels, who was his partner in the group, had recommended me, and I think Billy from The Cult, who was a friend of a lot of the bands I worked with, had also put in a good word for me. So
yeah.
Between them all, I somehow ended up in this situation. And yeah, it was weird because he told me, look, if you're interested, we're going to start recording in Switzerland in a studio called Mountain. And, you know, we want you to come in. And he told me a date.
Yeah.
And that date was literally like branded into my brain. I was like, oh, my God, on the whatever it was, 15th of March. I will be working with David Bowie, and I put the phone down, and it was branded. So, so then after that, I'm like, oh my God, it's really going to happen. So then a letter arrives with some tickets, and I put the tickets on the side.
Yeah.
I thought, I'm flying the day before, we're going to the studio. And you know what? I didn't read my ticket.
Yeah.
So they'd moved the dates to the one that he'd said, and I hadn't actually read the ticket.
Yeah.
Because I was just so
excited.
Yeah, I guess so. So was it the day the day before flying before flying to work with my hero.
Yeah,
I'm sitting at home listening to Station to Station or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And just listening to how it sounds and listening to how things work. And the phone rings and there's a Frenchman on the phone from Switzerland. But why are you not here? There's a studio with us now. I go, it's tomorrow. And he said, no, we start today.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I looked at the ticket, I'm like, oh my God, I just stood up David Bowie.
Yeah.
I haven't bothered to bothered to turn up on the first day.
So did you own it or did you come up with the story?
No, I owned it.
Yeah.
I said, look, can you get him on the phone? And I just said, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I just, when you said that day, I never thought about even looking at the ticket. And I've blown it, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, it's okay. I don't live very far. We'll just check the mics are all coming through, and we'll see you tomorrow. So that was a great start to the relationship.
Wow. That is incredible.
But we got there, and it wasn't long before Hunt and Tony arrived from Iggy Pop's backing band, you know, from Lust for Life.
So cool.
And Kevin Armstrong was there as well, and he was playing rhythm guitar. And basically, they set up in a very live situation.
Yeah, so everybody, was in the room.
Yeah, everyone was in a circle in the room, and it was my job to sort of, in a way, document that project. It wasn't really like a traditional production. It wasn't like we were sitting around discussing parts.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys were crazy. They would go out there, and they would run through a song, and I would be literally turning the EQs, setting it up, and they'd say that was the one.
Wow.
So on some of the songs you can actually hear. Yeah, I mean, that wasn't, you know, I thought, I went out there to produce a David Bowie album.
Right.
And for the first 2 weeks, it was a David Bowie album. But then when Hunt and Tony arrived and David saw the way that the chemistry was between the people, he said, this is a band.
I changed gears.
So
that's cool.
He said, let's call it Tin Machine. And part of me went, oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
I thought I was producing David Bowie.
Yeah. Dude, I would have been the same.
But
so I didn't know that. You didn't go there to do the Tin Machine album.
No, I went there to
I thought that was the idea the whole time.
I went there to work with David and Reeves.
Dude, that's incredible.
And we were working on the songs, and they had a very different shape.
Yeah.
But Hunt and Tony are just amazing personalities. They're just like crazy guys, and they're very spontaneous. And Hunt would go out there, and he would, as he was playing, if he didn't like the balance in the cans, he would literally grab hold of the microphones and pull them closer to his drums and things. he was insane.
Oh,
but but it was also a lot of fun, and also, you know, an amazing opportunity to watch David Bowie work and watch him sing, and just be part of that whole creative process. I mean, sometimes he would sort of make up a lyric as he goes along. He'd have a newspaper or whatever and make something up. So later we would then deconstruct the song, and he'd say, okay, let's have a listen to what I said. Can you solo my vocal? So I'd sit with him, and we would have pens and papers, and he'd say, what did I say there?
Oh, and he'd have to write it.
And I'd say, I think you said, there's a man lives round the corner. And he'd say, I don't think I said that, but I actually like that. Let's go with that. So, and we would go through it, and he would refine it and then re-sing it.
Dude.
But sometimes it was amazing to me how somebody like that, when you listen to all the records that he made and how he changed so much within each one of those albums, you wonder how that happened. Well, part of the reason it happens is because he leaves people alone.
Mm.
He allows them to express themselves on their particular instrument in their way. He knows what he wants, but he's not the sort of guy who'll say, well, you've got to be playing this and you've got to do that. And it's the same with his engineers.
Mm.
He never once said to me, you know what, I think I need a shorter reverb on that.
Yeah.
That's not his thing. He doesn't want to get involved in that.
In fact,
I remember when we were mixing the first Tin Machine album, he really liked the rough mix I did in Switzerland. So I said, oh, no, I need to do it again because there's a few things I got wrong. I want to rebalance. He's like, really? You sure you need to do it again? I said, yeah. He said, I'll tell you what we'll do. He said, I'll give you an hour. You've got 1 hour, and whatever you got after an hour, we'll use.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God. He goes, ready? Go! Like that. And I was like, quick. The reverb on here. Turn that there. It was quite a good way of doing things.
That's great.
Because you cut the shit, right? You only concentrate on the important things.
Yeah.
But, there's a million little things like that that happened on that record. Yeah, but it was great. One time I remember when we took a break between some recording, he called me up in London and he said, look, I need to buy a leather jacket for my son. And he said, I know you've got some cool leather jackets. Can you possibly tell me a good store? I thought, yeah. He said, why don't you just come with me? And I thought, go shopping with David Bowie. This is not going to happen.
Did you?
So I went to his hotel.
Come on.
And he had this black car outside. It was parked. And we jumped in the black car, him and I. And I said to the driver, look, take us to Kensington Market, right, which was great at the time.
About to ask if you went to Camden.
There was some there, but Kensington Market had this indoor market. And I used to always buy my clothes from Johnson's, which was La Rocca. Johnson's made the jacket for George Michael in the Faith video.
Oh, okay.
They had all the cool suits. I mean, they're just really great. And we went inside the market, jumped out the car, and I remember walking through the market and people going, I think that was David Bowie. And I took him into Johnson's and he was trying on jackets, going, what do you think of this one?
Oh,
and I was
my
like,
God.
This is surreal.
Who
I always
does
remember.
That?
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the funniest things that happened. I
was
going shopping with Dave.
Oh my God. Are you kidding me? I could listen to those stories all day. And it's not just David Bowie. Tim has stories with so many people. I would love to have just been a fly on the wall back in the day when he was working with all these people. I gotta say this. So Tim came up in the UK, if you didn't notice from the accent. Tim started his career in the UK at a time when you just worked for a studio. There wasn't the freelance type stuff that happens now. He got a job at a studio, so you never knew who was going to come in. He started at the studio just making tea and coffee and doing that sort of thing for artists. And the first person he ever made a cup of tea for was Stevie Wonder. I swear, this guy, just his life has been insane. And he's not even that old. He's not that old. And he's had this incredible life, continues to. When he graduated from tea making and started getting behind the desk and mixing, one of the first, if not the first thing he did was Died in Your Arms Tonight with Cutting Crew. I just died in your arms tonight. Like, that was the first thing he did, and that was a number one single. Oh, what a guy. And what a great time we had chatting. We actually talked for a really long time. He made me a cup of coffee. I got to meet his puppy. He's got a new puppy there. And we just hung out and had a conversation about music and about the business. And you know, I think that's what I love about this podcast is that that's what it feels like. And that's what I want it to feel like when I'm talking to these people. Tim also wanted me to mention, and I want to make sure I remember to do this. So Tim's the Texas trustee for the Recording Academy. And the Recording Academy isn't all about the Grammys. They do a lot to try and help artists. And they're trying to make some changes in the industry to better it for artists. Tim's also involved in wonderful organizations like Music Cares. And I can't say it enough. He's just a great, great dude. It's so nice when people are successful in this business and they're good people. And Tim is definitely good people. If you want to know more about Tim and just kind of see the insane discography the man has, go visit timpalmer.com. It'll blow your mind. I'm not exaggerating when I say it's insane. Thanks again to Tim for sitting down with me. Thank you for listening. Please don't forget to rate, review, and share the podcast. How cool would it be to get it to number one? We've cracked the top 10. Let's get this thing to number one. Honestly, I'm totally humbled. I'm super thankful everybody's loving this podcast so far. I'm going to keep up the good work. You guys keep listening. And see you next Tuesday. This episode was produced, edited, and mixed by Luke Bronner. The artwork we used for this podcast was done by Heather Hale. Please visit halehouse.co for more of her stuff. The theme music you hear is from my band's latest album, The Devil's in the Detail. Please visit Ryan Hamilton and thetraitors.com for more.